to their developmental health, can affect their lifelong health that might occur in these children's products.
So it could be clothes or toys or anything of that sort?
Exactly. Clothes or toys or, you know, soothing products for infants. Any product that is made specifically for children is covered by this law. There's some exceptions, but for the most part, what Oregon Health Authority is going to look at is, you know, when these products are sold in Oregon, if these chemicals occur, and it may be any of 66 different chemicals, they have to report, the manufacturers have to report. So for the first time, we'll get a really good inventory of the kinds of exposures that might happen in everyday life for a little kid.
These could be made in New York State or in Taiwan or wherever. Is that correct?
That's right. And it's a law that is modeled after Washington State. Washington State was the first to start doing this kind of inventory. Oregon takes it a step further. So we not only get this inventory, but then after a certain period of time, the manufacturers have to either replace that chemical with something that is proven to be safer or eliminate it altogether.
Wow, that's really important.
Yes, it's very exciting. It's very exciting. And it's, you know, even as the law changes on a federal level, this kind of state law can have huge ripple effects all the way through the economy. You know, we've seen it happen in Washington just when they had to report that they're using these chemicals, you started to see manufacturers reformulate so that they wouldn't have to report. So if we have that added impetus to say you need to start looking for safer alternatives, just getting a process in place to look at safer alternatives is a huge change in the way people do business.
So because we were second to Washington a little bit later, it really helped in a sense. And of course, Washington has a larger population.
Yeah, and I think what happens is that, you know, Washington sort of made it possible. You can see that this inventory works, that it made it possible for Oregon to go a little bit further. But we're going to have a law that means that anybody, no matter where it's manufactured, if they sell in Oregon, they have to find safer alternatives. And that's going to have worldwide effects.
And the research might be very interesting, too.
Exactly. And we're also looking at, on the federal level, they've done some reform of the big overarching chemical control law called the Toxic Chemicals Control Act, Toxic Substances Control Act. And this will inform the way that law goes forward as well. Now, here's the opportunity. This law it took 5 years to put it in place. It took a long slog of a lot of negotiation and a lot of rhetoric, and we finally got that law in place. The next step is rulemaking. So Oregon has to figure out how they're going to put rules in place that manufacturers can follow so that they actually start receiving that information. And that process of rulemaking is a stakeholder process. So you have manufacturers and trade associations, national trade associations, coming to the table trying to influence the way that this law goes forward. And then you have one advocacy organization at that table as well.
One advocacy. And is that the Oregon Environmental Council?
And it is the Oregon Environmental Council. So what we're looking at now is looking for support from Oregonians and from health professionals and from everyone who cares about this law to come out and support the way that these rules are made. So that's why I'm here today, is to see if I can get some of these public health folks to come out and testify in favor of the way that these laws are constructed.
How can someone learn what the process is at this point that they might be able to support? Where is their website?
Yes. So Oregon Environmental Council, oeconline.org, has more information about this if you sign up for the Action Network. And the opportunity that's coming up is October 18th in Portland. There's going to be an open hearing for the public to come in and say what they think about the way these rules are drafted. And the reason we need people to come out, like, even if you don't know anything about the issue, if you just care about children's health and children's exposure, we need people in the room to support these strong rules, because you know that there are going to be paid trade associations in there as well, looking for ways to punch holes in it and create loopholes.
Right. And you don't want people to say, this can't be done.
Exactly.
Or if they do, to have a counter.
And the Oregon Health Authority has done a really good job of drafting rules that are going to work, but they need to be able to have a backstop of public support saying, good idea, protect these kids and be strong about it.
Thank you very much for talking with me this afternoon at the OPHA.
My pleasure. So glad to see you here.
Glad to see you. My guest is Brian Johnson. He's with Lane County Public Health, and he mainly does epidemiology, if I'm remembering right.
That's correct, yep.
He was the president a few years back. But today we're talking about public health modernization, and I'd like him to explain a little bit about it.
Well, let me give it a try. I really think of public health modernization as expanding upon what we already do and growing our ability to be more responsive to the new age of what it means to do public health. For example, our ability to better handle emergencies and new and emerging illnesses such as Zika or a few years back, H1N1. It's really building the capacity of our public health system to be more responsive and able to deal with these new threats that really didn't exist in the same way in years before.
Yesterday, we heard a lot about the public health impacts of climate change, and that may be one of them.
Exactly. Climate change is a good example of something we've started to better understand and realize that there are serious public health implications. Our system isn't necessarily set up to easily respond to those sorts of things without a greater investment, really, in getting the right training and the right folks in there who have a better understanding and ability to think about and provide science and provide sound evidence in our ability to respond.
Well, just for example, what if Zika showed up in a patient or two in Lane County?
Certainly, we would be responding now, and we've got trained nurses and staff that already follow up on any type of infectious disease investigation. The difference might be that we would have greater capacity to actively monitor or to pick things up a little earlier in the process before they've really expanded and show up in our community at a high numbers. You know, often it's a real struggle to stay ahead of the game, and I think that's what it would do. You know, our ability to work with labs and lab systems more effectively, our ability to actually collect data and information more effectively from our healthcare partners, all of those things would help us to have a better handle and stay ahead of the game instead of what we often struggle with now is to be ahead of the game, but also to sometimes we're just having to respond as soon as something comes up as opposed to taking care of it before it really becomes an issue. So, and I think the challenge is we don't often invest enough in the system to make sure that we can do that effectively.
You just a minute ago said the word partners. Is developing more partners part of this change?
And that's a new thing. But when you think about modernization of public health, part of that is really investing in our ability to collaborate and our ability to partner. It's really bringing in and having that staff and expertise that can really build those partnerships and grow them effectively.
Would they be, for instance, with the school district?
Absolutely. School districts, you know, a lot of times we think about transportation and its effects on health. So partnering with our transportation partners, our housing partners, food systems, those sorts of things that really have impacts on our health that we didn't often think about in the past and or put enough energy into. And if we can do that more effectively, certainly we can deal better with things like chronic diseases, which will continue to be an ongoing challenge for us and probably still the leading cause of death.
Diabetes,
heart disease, you know, cancers, those sorts of things.
The legislative part of this, though, maybe we could just talk 1 minute about that.
Sure. So what's happened so far is the legislation set the stage for an investment in understanding where our current health system is and then putting forth a recommendation. So that legislation set the stage for what the current recommendations that are moving forward as what we're thinking of as the modernization of public health in Oregon. So the next stage really is to think about, are we going to act upon those particular recommendations? Are we going to invest at the levels that are potentially identified to make that happen? Are there other sorts of things we might put in place, such as powers or abilities for the local public health to more effectively do their work? Those are the sorts of steps that would be in consideration next. But right now, what's currently in place was really just that investment in where are we now, where do we want to be, and what's it going to take to get there. So,
okay. So now there's sort of a plan.
I mean, what's nice about that is it was guided by an advisory group that was from folks from many, many different sectors, not just public health, but health systems and elected officials and others who came to these conclusions as to where we are now and what do we want to do about it. So,
well, thank you. That helps a great deal. So that is a partnership in itself in
exactly.
The planning process. Well, good luck with it.
Well, thank you. Good luck for all of us. I think it has the potential to really improve our livability in Oregon by investing in our health system. So,
very good. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
My guest is Helen Belanca. She is an associate director of HealthShare, which is a CCO, coordinated care organization in the Portland area and several counties.
I'm the Associate Medical Director, and we work in Multnomah County, Washington County, and Clackamas County.
Well, welcome to the program. We're just doing a little conversation about her keynote speech at the OPHA on Tuesday, October 11. It was a great talk, and so we're just recapping a little bit of it.
Thanks.
The title is quite interesting. I'll let you give it.
The title was Sandwiches to Space Shuttles. And I use that reference. It's from a Calvin and Hobbes comic. Calvin and Hobbes are talking about what they would wish for if they could wish for anything in the world. Hobbes wishes for a sandwich, and Calvin wishes for his own private continent and $1 trillion and his own space shuttle. And then when they're back later at the house, we see Hobbes happily eating his sandwich and saying, well, I got my wish. And the idea is that we could wish for simple, practical things like a sandwich that we know that we can get, or we can think about wishing for something much bigger, much more aspirational, like a space shuttle, which is a much bigger vision and much more complicated, but will also sort of get us closer to the vision of an integrated health system that we're all interested in having.
And so ultimately, you say you need both. You need both kinds of people and ideas working in a system, because it's really good to achieve something at the end of a day.
Yeah. I don't think it's the case that it either has to be achievable or aspirational. I think you can have both, that it's somewhat of a false dichotomy, and that as we build achievable goals and plans in our work, we could make sure that they are also aspirational and think about how our roles should change in the community and how our partnerships should change so that we can get closer to an ideal vision.
And I should say about Helen, she has an MD degree. She's a family physician and has practiced. She also has an MPH, a Master of Public Health. And that was because she found that in practicing medicine, you're dealing with individuals and they're all sick. And a bigger vision and a community vision is useful too. Am I summarizing that okay?
That's right. Yeah, it's that idea that the healthcare system is really oriented toward illness, and the public health community has an orientation toward health. And I think the healthcare system can learn a lot from the public health community in building a system that is more oriented toward health and advancing health rather than just treating illness.
So I like the way she talked about the coordinated care organizations, which is a unique term, I think, to Oregon, but something similar to it is being talked about nationally. It's a different way to deliver health care, but the way I interpreted what she said, it's organizing health care delivery within the principles of public health. So you put those two together. She gave such interesting examples of how the two work together. I'd like her to just mention one or two.
Yes, so you're right. The model is unique to Oregon, but it's very similar to in other states and elsewhere in the country where they're doing accountable care organizations. And accountable care organizations just means that we need to think about the quality of care that we deliver and be accountable for that quality as we deliver it. And that's certainly a feature of CCOs, but CCOs go beyond that and say that in order to best address people's healthcare needs, we need to integrate physical health care with mental health care and with dental health care, substance use disorder treatment, and the community supports that people need in order to achieve optimal health. So it's a much bigger vision than just accountable care. And so the examples that I talked about are places where CCOs have partnered with our public health departments locally, with our state public health department, with our counties, with community organizations, community serving organizations to advance that. And the one area, one example of that would be our family well-being assessment. This is a questionnaire that was developed by a committee of the Oregon Perinatal Collaborative. And it was really designed for women entering prenatal care. It's really a clinical tool to use in clinics where women are receiving prenatal care. And it screens them for mental health concerns, substance use disorders, domestic violence, and basic resource needs like housing and food and childcare. At the end of the assessment, there are a number of strategies for how to connect pregnant women with the resources they might need to optimize their health during pregnancy. Maybe they need a behavioral health clinician that's already in place at the clinic. Maybe they need a home visiting program that's run through the county. Maybe they need maternity case management, or maybe they need to be connected with a community organization that can help them with rent assistance or with food insecurity issues. And so it's, in a way, it's teaching the healthcare system how to connect with the broader system of care and supports that are available for families in our communities. And it's teaching those systems, the public health systems and the community systems, about how to better communicate with the healthcare. So, because we're all part of the same team. We're all caring for the same families. And so it's a really great example of how we can build partnerships across sectors in order to optimize people's health.
And that has been somewhat lacking. As many people have pointed out, many people have talked about the disparity in payment that in this country, we put $3 trillion into patient care, direct patient care, and as far as public health, what is the...
$80 billion compared to $3
trillion. $80 billion compared to $3 trillion. And it's been said by past leader of Medicaid Medicare Services, Don Berwick, who talked on August 1, that of the $3 trillion, about a third is wasted. That was his sad comment. He said, as he's learned more over the years, he wishes there were things that he didn't know, but he has to know them and wants to make those changes. And organizing patient services in a more coordinated fashion, Oregon thought, would help to address that very issue. So that was the topic of the talk today, and there were many excellent questions. One rather strange one, I thought. Maybe you didn't think it was strange. It was a question about whether these coordinated care organizations have changed the way care is delivered for other sectors of the population, other sectors than those who are enrolled in the Oregon Health Plan. The reason I thought it was strange was that hey, they're not affected. It only serves one quarter of the population, that quarter of the population that is enrolled in the Oregon Health Plan.
That's true. Right now, the coordinated care experiment, coordinated care organizations are really limited to the Medicaid population. But there's been a lot of talk in our state about the coordinated care model and how the principles of coordinated care should apply across all sectors, that commercially insured people and people with Medicare or other types of insurance, really the principles and the models can be transferred. Basically, you know, use a population health perspective, make sure people have the care management services they need, make sure the systems are accountable for quality and patient satisfaction, make sure there's broad access. So while CCOs right now only cover the Medicaid population, there's a lot to learn from the model that can be applied elsewhere.
And the question is, can the structures be massaged or manipulated or rethought in order to accommodate that? Perhaps that's the big challenge of our time.
Yes, it is. I agree.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Roberta. I really appreciate you taking the time to have me on the show. Thank you.
Thank you. My guests are two nurses, Nancy Sullivan and Chris Tanner. They're working on a particular project within nursing, but first let's welcome them, Nancy and Chris.
Thank you. Very happy to be here.
Yes, happy to be here as well, talking to you about the movement for single-payer health care and for the role that nurses are going to be playing in that effort in Oregon.
Well, nurses have a great reputation in general, and of course there are all kinds of nurses and all kinds of nursing. Tell me about what your backgrounds are in terms of nursing experience and why you were attracted to this particular topic.
Well, I went to nursing school in New York in the late 70s because I had lived in France for 5 years. I was married and had a baby in France, and I had a midwife there, and they had a wonderful healthcare system where you just got health care. You didn't ever worry about payment. I came back to the States and went to nursing school so that I could go to a graduate school in midwifery, which I did at Columbia University. And in 1985, we moved to Oregon, and I got a job at Oregon Health and Sciences University teaching in the nurse midwifery program, which I did for about 20 years. And then I worked at Providence for a while as a nurse midwife and doing some other clinical work before I retired.
Okay, Nancy. How about you, Chris?
I have been a nurse since 1969. I went to nursing school in Colorado. Spent the first 4 years of my career mostly working in hospitals and intensive care units, and then went into academics and spent most of my career at Oregon Health and Science University, with my last position there being the dean of the School of Nursing, the interim dean. and I retired from that position 2 years ago. During my time at OHSU, I worked with nurses all over the state to do major reform of nursing education. And I saw the power of nurses working together, nurses who really believed that, as we put it, that Oregon's health depended on nurses being well-prepared, well-educated, and serving as advocates for their patients. This kind of close working relationship with nurses in every town that has a community college or an OHSU campus really gave me great faith in nurses' ability to lead social change, which is what our educational project was. When I retired from that work, several of my colleagues and I vowed to now take on healthcare, since we could reform nursing education. And so, you know, we all witness every day the impact of our crazy financing system, of people losing homes and, you know, their resources because of medical bankruptcy, people putting off care because they can't afford it, people not taking medications because they've gotten outrageously expensive. Really, we can't provide better care until we can figure out a more sane financing system. And so when I retired, it took a little while to figure out what I wanted to do with my retired time. And I got on a single-payer comprehensive universal health plan for people over 65 called Medicare. And I think everybody ought to have it.
That's an interesting way to put it. And it sounds like between the two of you, you've, as we used to say, slain one dragon at a time.
Well, we're working on it.
Well, this is a big one.
Yes.
A very big one.
A very big one.
Very complex.
Yeah. So are you working within the Oregon Nurses Association, separate groups?
We have a core group.
Yes.
Of nurses that actually started this movement before we came on, who are affiliated, most of the nurses, with the Oregon Nurses Association. But it's not come up yet as a major policy agenda for the Oregon Nurses Association, though we're hoping to change that.
My goodness. I think California nurses have done that. Am I wrong about
that? That's right. Yeah, and the New York State Nurses Association have been extremely successful through their work in continuing education of nurses throughout the state. The House, New York House, has passed a single-payer bill. It's not passed the Senate yet. Mm-hmm. But nurses have really single-handedly led that, is our understanding in New York. And there's also the National Nurses Union.
National Nurses United is the largest nursing union in the United States, and really big in California. They have 185,000 members, and health care for all is very high on their agenda. So they are working in California and in other states where they are a prominent player to promote single-payer health care.
And in Oregon, I remember reading your abstract. I think I'm remembering 55,000 nurses. Is that correct?
That's right.
Yes. So we want to somehow reach all 55,000 of those nurses, but we're really trying to focus on maybe 10,000 who we can reach through education and information sessions in nursing schools and other venues, and get them to agree to go out as ambassadors for single-payer healthcare themselves in their communities, get their patients, their colleagues and others, neighbors, everyone. I'm their nurses in every corner of Oregon, in every community, large and small. And I think they are the perfect ones to do this, particularly as you said, Bobby, they are highly respected by people. We always come out as the most highly respected profession. Everyone knows a nurse in their community. So we're thinking nurses can really play a major role in this.
Do you think that some of the employers of these nurses will push back, or how will that work? Have you thought about that issue?
One advantage of working through universities, you know, there's a little bit more flexibility, I think, in nurses being able to take, and faculty being able to take positions without danger of job loss. So I think that people have the right to speak out for their beliefs and what they believe is right, and I think there will be some who will be fearful of that. And I think part of our work with them will have to be, how do you work that through and, you know, make it so we can be safe?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very interesting.
You know, I think there's a fear of retribution, but also fear if we actually change financing, would be economic reasons for job loss. And I think both of those are concerns that won't be addressed in our conversations.
Oh, I should ask one other question that just occurred to me. When you say nurses, are you speaking of RNs or other, you know, there are various types of nurses,
right?
There are.
There are.
I'm a nurse practitioner legally in the state of Oregon. Nurse midwives are a class of nurse practitioner. So I'm a nurse practitioner. In order to be in that category, you have to have a master's degree and in a specific field, and then you can work as a nurse practitioner. I think we welcome all nurses. The Oregon Nurses Association has a number of subcategories of nurses that they represent.
In terms of your outreach, it's nurses, period.
Nurses. And,
period.
Yeah. Period,
right.
Yes.
Right. Our focus, the 55,000 number represents the registered nurses. And of course, there are nurse practitioners, about 3,000 or so, mm-hmm, I think, mm-hmm, and licensed vocational or practical nurses, maybe 1,500 to 2,000. Mm-hmm. In the state, I'm not sure the numbers there. But.
Interesting. I'm going to tell you a secret about my own background. From 64 to 66, I was a librarian at a hospital school of nursing.
Oh.
One of the last. And in our library, of course, a lot of the literature concerned the changeover because they all knew it was coming.
Yes.
And we're working on it. So it's just kind of interesting. This was
evolution.
In Illinois. So you're going through the educational system as much as you possibly can.
Right.
Education of nurses,
right.
And so working with instructors, perhaps deans or, mm-hmm, you know, the leaders.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, also we're connected with their communities and with nurses in the community.
So, for instance, there's a program here at Lynn Benton Community College in nursing. So it might be, its leadership might be approached, can we give a seminar or can we,
exactly.
Is that the,
exactly.
That
yes.
the type right. of, and of course we need to say that we're right now at the Oregon Public Health Association, and you're giving a talk very, very soon this afternoon, Monday, right. October 10th.
And
yes.
On Thursday, we're going to Hood River to give a talk to the Nurse Practitioners of Oregon.
Wonderful.
Right.
And they're having a general meeting.
Yes, yeah. It's their annual conference, so we're speaking at that as well.
Those are the places. Well.
And then in Monmouth in November to the senior students at Oregon Health and Science University campus in Monmouth, Oregon, in their health policy class.
So wouldn't you mind giving your email address or a website that anyone who was involved in education could reach you?
So yeah. nursesforsinglepayer.org.
Yes.
Nursesforsinglepayer.org is right. The way if someone wanted to more information or to request.
And just call right to info@nursesforsinglepayer.org.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, Chris and Nancy, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for doing this.
The Health and Healthcare Forum is produced by Roberta Hall. Theme music was composed by Lori Childers and played by Lori Childers and Kent White.
You are tuned to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Bill McKibben Lecture in Portland, taking place Sunday, October 23rd at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. Bill McKibben, world-renowned environmental activist, author, educator, and founder of 350.org, will speak about climate action beyond Paris. Again, that's Bill McKibben in Portland at the First Unitarian Church, 1121 Southwest Main Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now the KBOO News at Noon for Monday, October 17th, 2016, in local news. According to a new legal analysis issued by the Oregon Legislative Council, instituting a ban on no-fault evictions in the city of Portland would contradict state law and be unenforceable. Amid the population boom and tight rental market, rental prices have skyrocketed over the last few years, causing a housing affordability crisis. The housing crisis caused the Portland City Council to officially declare a housing emergency for the city. One tactic the City Council was considering was banning no-cause evictions where the landlord evicts a tenant in order to significantly raise the rent for the new tenant. But the new analysis by the Oregon Legislative Council concluded that the ban would violate state law and that an amendment would be required. Both Portland Mayor-elect Ted Wheeler and Tina Kotek, the Speaker of the House for the Oregon State Legislature, have both stated they would support changing the law to allow banning no-cause evictions. The Oregon Legislature meets again next year. In regional news, a major coal exporter has dropped its bid to establish two coal export terminals on the Columbia River. Lighthouse Resources announced last Friday that the company was abandoning its fight to secure the right to ship coal to Asian markets from export terminals on the Columbia River in both Boardman and Longview. Instead, the company, which mines upward to 6 million tons of coal per year, will ship the coal from ports located just south of Vancouver, British Columbia, near the U.S. border. The prospective terminals in Oregon and Washington were met with fierce opposition and extensive publicity over the last several years. The permit for the Boardman project was denied by the state of Oregon in 2014, and an appeal to overturn a ruling was denied this year in the Oregon courts. Despite the announcement by Lighthouse Resources to abandon the Longview port, that coal export terminal continues to move towards approval, with several other coal exporters still on board, and the project has received a favorable draft environmental impact statement from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. In national news, last week President Obama gave a speech criticizing the independent media, which he called the Wild Wild West. The president noted the media received higher trust ratings when there were only three news channels to choose from. In the speech at an innovation conference in Pittsburgh, the president called for a way to be developed that could curate the news that people receive. Critics charged the president with advocating impinging on the freedom of speech and the freedom of the press, noting that curating means to organize, select, and manage. The president denied he was calling for censorship of the media. In international news, tensions in the Middle East remain extremely high as U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and his Russian counterpart met in Europe over the weekend. No ceasefire was agreed to, and fighting raged in Aleppo, where several thousand rebels fighting the Syrian government remain in control of the town but are surrounded with supply lines cut off.